Thank you very much, Holly, and good evening, everyone. Great to have you here tonight, and a special welcome if you're visiting. As Lucas said, it's great to have you here with us. We're just doing this special day across our services today, thinking about the need to raise up gospel workers. And so we've got this kind of one-off sermon in Matthew chapter 9, and then next week we're starting a new sermon series, and we're going to work our way through the book of Ecclesiastes, which I'm really looking forward to, so I hope you can join us for that as well. Do keep your Bibles open, Matthew chapter 9, verse 35 to 38, and we're going to think about those verses. It'd be helpful if you had them in front of you as we do so. One of the things my wife Melody and I enjoy doing is going for walks. And so often on a Monday morning, we have the opportunity to go out for a walk, and it's a special time for us. Melody wears glasses, and so often she's quite sensitive to the bright light, so she'll put on her sunnies, her prescription sunnies, and we'll be walking along, kind of Taylor's Mistake is one of our favourite spots, somewhere like that, and she'll comment on how beautiful the colours are, the clouds, or the blueness of the ocean, or the grass is so green, or that kind of thing. And then she'll get back to the car and take the glasses off and swap and realise that actually a lot of it was because of the tints on her sunnies, which she now calls her heavenly glasses, because they just make everything look so much brighter than they actually are in reality. I think when we see people, we often see people with some kind of tint on our eyes. We see people through some kind of lens. And I think there are a few different lenses that perhaps people have on when they look at crowds of people. One lens is maybe, let's call it a generosity lens, where they see people as just kind of always in a positive light, like no one can do anything wrong. And they always think the best of people, and there's this kind of this love for other people that kind of flows out from them because that's how they see people. They're the kind of people who slightly annoy me because they're right and I'm not like that and I get a bit jealous. But anyway, there's people like that, they exist. And then there are people who have an empathetic lens, where what they can do when they look out at people is they seem to be able to see great needs, and they become very aware of the needs of the people that they see and the people they talk to, and they often can kind of feel those needs themselves and carry it with them, so kind of an empathetic lens. There's two other lenses that are more like me. One's like a self-righteous lens, where I just kind of think I'm better than everyone else. I know it's only me that thinks that, but you know, it's that tendency to kind of see people doing something that you know is not right. You're like, oh, yeah, I'm not like that. Shame on them. You know, they've made some bad decisions. I'm so thankful. No one else is like that, I take it. But sometimes that happens for me. Another lens that I sometimes have on, actually most of the time, is a kind of self-centered lens where I don't even really see people. I just see obstacles. So you know what I mean? Like you go to the grocery shop and you're trying to get in and out of the shop and there's people, I think they're people, there's things standing there and they're taking like 10 minutes to choose their breakfast cereal when I just want to get past them. It's like, get out of my way, don't you know who I am? Or you're sitting in the traffic lights and the light turns green and nobody moves. What is wrong with you people? And it's like I'm the only person that exists in my little world. Shame on me when we think like that, right? Well, I'm sure it's only me, but what we get in Matthew chapter 9 is the lens with which Jesus sees people. And it's my prayer tonight that as we see the way that Jesus sees people, we might become more like Jesus and see people the way that he does. We're going to look at this short section, verse 35 to 38, under two really simple headings, the need and the solution. The need and the solution. So first then, the need. When Jesus looks at people, he sees a great need. Now, we're just kind of parachuting into Matthew chapter 9. We haven't looked at chapters 1 to 8. But let me just give you really briefly a little bit of the context. Matthew, the person who writes this book, has been making the point really clearly that this man, Jesus, who lived in the first century, was no ordinary man. And Matthew's argument is that Jesus is God, God's chosen king. That Jesus is the one who rules over this world, and that he proves that that's the case by the way that Jesus responds to people and meets the needs of people. And so if you just have a look at, if you've got a Bible open, and you know there's those headings above the sections, they can be helpful for kind of orientating ourselves a wee bit. And let me just read you the headings in my Bible, and you'll see a picture of what Jesus has been doing. So chapter 8, my heading in my Bible is the man with leprosy. So Jesus just kind of touches this man with the skin disease and heals him completely. Then there's the faith of the centurion, and it tells the story of the centurion who trusted Jesus to be able to heal his servant with just a word, and Jesus does so.
Then we're told that Jesus heals many. He heals Peter's mother-in-law who was sick in bed with a fever. And then all of these people come to Jesus with all sorts of sicknesses, possessed by evil spirits, and Jesus heals all of them. Then we're told that Jesus calms the storm. There's this raging storm, and with just a word, Jesus tells the wind and waves to shut up, and they obey him. Then you have Jesus heal two demon-possessed men. Then he heals a paralytic man. He says to this guy who's never walked in his life, "Son, your sins are forgiven. And so that you may know that I do actually have the power to forgive you your sins, get up and walk." And the man does. Then Jesus goes on and he raises a dead girl to life. And then he heals a woman who'd been bleeding for 12 years. Then he heals two blind men. And then a man who'd never been able to speak before. Do you see what's happening? Like, Jesus is just doing these extraordinary things that not even Jesus' enemies can deny. And Matthew is making the point really clear. Jesus is no ordinary man. He is God's king who rules over this world. And it's not that surprising then that as Jesus performs these extraordinary miracles and does things that only God could do, there are crowds of people who start to gather around Jesus. And so we're told in chapter 9, verse 35, Jesus went through all of the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness. And so understandably, as Jesus travels around, there are crowds that follow him. And these crowds are full of suffering people. There are people who are sick, who need help, and that's why they come to Jesus. And so Jesus looks out at this crowd of sick, suffering people, and we're told he's filled with compassion in verse 36. This is the lens that Jesus has on when he sees this crowd. He is filled with compassion. And you would be, wouldn't you? I mean, you imagine if all of the hospitals kind of emptied out and the crowd of patients was in front of it, you'd be filled with compassion because there's so much need. I don't think it's particularly surprising that Jesus looks at the crowd with compassion. I take it, I hope, you and I would do the same. But what is surprising is why he is filled with compassion. I wonder if you noticed it. Let me read verse 36 again. When Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. You notice that? He's not filled with compassion because of their physical sickness like you and I would be. No, Jesus sees an even deeper need. A need that is more serious, a need that is more urgent, a need that is more concerning than being sick or being lame, a need that is even more serious than dying. Jesus sees a deeper need. He sees this crowd of people not as those who are physically sick, but as those who are harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. He looks beyond their physical need and he sees a great, much greater spiritual need. And that is why he's filled with compassion. Now, we live in New Zealand, so we know sheep, right? Like, the sheep outnumber us by a lot. There's a lot of sheep. We know what sheep are like. And my experience of sheep is that they're pretty dumb. My wife grew up in Southland. I've seen quite a few sheep down there. And I remember on a few different occasions, one, the sheep just lying in the paddock, lying on its back, legs up in the air, kicking and flailing about, and it can't even get itself up. And if you leave a sheep on its back like that, it'll actually die because it can't get up to feed itself. Or on another occasion, the sheep that had kind of wandered off on its own and got stuck in a fence and it was kind of wrestling with the wire, and the more it kind of twisted its head around, the more it got tangled in. Have others seen that kind of thing? Like, sheep need someone to protect them. When my son Caleb heard the sermon a little bit earlier, he said, "Dad, you should tell them about that YouTube video where there's a sheep in a ditch. And then they work really hard to get the sheep out." People have seen it. I already see some smiles. And then it kind of zigzags, and then like 30 seconds later jumps back in the ditch again. Like, sheep are dumb. They need a shepherd. They need someone to care for them, to lead them, to provide for them. And it's not just that they're dumb and they need a leader. It's that they're vulnerable. Sheep have got little blunt teeth for chewing grass. They can't fight off predators. They're vulnerable. They need a shepherd. And Jesus is filled with compassion because he sees people like sheep without a shepherd. Harassed and helpless, vulnerable, and unable to protect themselves. Now, it strikes me that Jesus' view of people is very different to the view of our society. The humanist argues that we have all of the resources that we need within us, that we can make a better world for ourselves without any need for God. But Jesus' summary of humanity has to be right, doesn't it? Because if we were created by God and God made us and designed us in order to live with him as our loving ruler, our leader, our shepherd, who provides and protects and cares for us, if he made us to be like that, dependent on him, then if we reject him, then we will be at the mercy of every evil, defenseless against our enemies. If we say no to the loving rule of God, we will be at the mercy of every evil force. And that's as true for a society as it is for an individual. We live at the end of 100 or 150 years or so, where constructing a society without the need for God has been the purpose. It was Friedrich Nietzsche in 1880 who said boldly, "God is dead." And some historians have commented that the last century has just been a footnote to that comment. Like, we've just seen that play out as we try to write God out of the picture and live without him. Russian author Dostoevsky wrote in a book called The Brothers Karamazov, I'm probably saying that wrong, it's a Russian word, but he writes this: if God is dead and there is no future life, nothing would be immoral anymore. And everything would be permitted. If God is dead, then where is truth? And if there isn't truth, then what happens to trust? And if there isn't trust, then what happens to relationships? And if there's no relationships, then what happens to humanity? Defenseless confusion, like sheep without a shepherd. You see, this picture of sheep and shepherds, it's actually a picture that the Bible uses often and all through the Old Testament about God's people and specifically about the nation of Israel and their need spiritually. So Isaiah chapter 53 says, "You all like sheep have gone astray. Each has wandered to his own way, away from God." It's a picture of our spiritual state. First the nation of Israel, but in the New Testament extended to all nations. We thought that we would be free of God and that we had everything we needed without ourselves if we just get rid of toxic religion. But Jesus says we're lost, sheep without a shepherd. And can't we see the reality of that around us? I mean, is New Zealand any better off as it moves further and further away from God? As we reject Christianity and its moral values, the fences which God puts up to protect us, and we ignore them, is society any better? Friends, there's just confusion everywhere, isn't there? The loss of truth leaves us walking around blindly. Our society is full of people who are lonely, confused, directionless, confused about gender and sexuality, confused about their purpose and their meaning and their identity, confused about what to believe and who to listen to. People just full of stress and anxiety, burdened. Do you know people like that? Society is full of hurting people, moving from one relationship to the next, looking for some kind of love and connection, chasing experiences, looking for satisfaction, accumulating wealth, searching for happiness, working 60 or more hours a week to try to make a name for ourselves, grieving sickness and death without any hope. We are sheep without a shepherd. And if we can't see it all around us in this life, then we can certainly see it in the face of death, can't we? Because even if we get through this life relatively unscathed and pretty happily, eventually we will face the most terrifying predator that no one escapes, death itself. And we've got no answer. And it's a terrifying thing to die and then face judgment before the God we wandered away from. So Jesus says we are sheep without a shepherd. He looks at this crowd and he sees their deep need. They need a shepherd. They need someone to lead them, protect them, care for them. The leaders of Israel in the Old Testament had all failed to care for God's people. They were failed shepherds. And in the book of Ezekiel, God therefore promises to come himself and shepherd his people. And so he does. in the man Jesus. God himself who came to gather his people to himself. Jesus himself is the shepherd that this crowd needs. And so elsewhere Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. And the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. So Jesus looks at this crowd. He sees people. He looks at our culture, our society. He sees people and he sees the need that we have for him, the good shepherd. He sees beneath the surface physical needs of people and sees a deep spiritual need for him. And so let me ask you, is that how you see people? A sheep without a shepherd. Do you see people all around you as those who desperately need the good shepherd? As you look at crowds in Riverside Market or whatever mall you go to, as you go to work and you share your office with people, as you're at university or at school, on the sports field, in your neighborhood, you see people all around you. Do you see them as sheep without a shepherd who need the good shepherd, Jesus? People who are confused and lost, hurting. And does that need fill you with compassion? Because it does for Jesus. He's filled with compassion. He doesn't come wagging the finger in judgment. You know, like, you wicked sinners, I told you should never wander away. You're going to pay for what you've done. He doesn't do that, does he? He's filled with compassion. And he longs to gather his sheep back to himself. And so he says, I am the good shepherd who came to seek and to save the lost. And the word for compassion, it literally kind of refers to your guts, like your entrails, like your intestines. It's this kind of really deep, gut-wrenching compassion. I sometimes feel that when you see those photos of like starving children that sometimes come up on the TV screen. You know the ones I mean, where it's just like these poor children, skin and bones, bloated bellies, no food, flies crawling over them, and you just go, oh my, that poor child. I wish I could help. And you feel it in your gut. That's the kind of feeling that Jesus has as he sees people without him. These poor people. Hurting, burdened. Sheep without a shepherd. Do you know, I've realized that one of the things that prevents me from doing more evangelism and speaking more about Jesus is not that I don't see the need. Like, I know people need Jesus. Because without Jesus, there's no forgiveness of sins. Without Jesus, there's no hope beyond death. I know people need Jesus. And I suspect that a lot of us in this room know that that's true as well. And let me just say, if you're here tonight and you're not sure what you make of Jesus, I just want to encourage you, Jesus is the shepherd that you need. If you're one of these people who feels harassed and helpless and burdened, then come to Jesus. Most of us have discovered that he's the good shepherd. And so we know that people need Jesus. But do you know what actually stops me doing evangelism? It's not that I don't know people need Jesus. I think it's a lack of compassion. I just don't care enough. I don't love people enough. And so I'd rather kind of protect myself from any kind of fallout of being so bold as to mention Jesus. I need to learn from Jesus to feel what he feels, a gut-wrenching compassion, so that I don't then just see the need, but I actually do something about it. Which leads to our second thing, what's the solution? The need is Jesus, people need Jesus, and therefore the solution is simple. We need to tell them about Jesus. And so in verse 37, Jesus changes the metaphor and he moves from talking about sheep to talking about wheat. Have a look in verse 37. He said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. You know, a field of wheat takes about, I had to Google this, I'm no farmer, but it takes about 4 months to mature. And then once it's matured, there's like this really short window in which it's got to be harvested. And if a farmer doesn't get it just when it's right, then the longer they wait, the wheat loses its quality and quantity. And so they have a much smaller harvest of much lower quality, and therefore they can't make as much money. And in the space of just a few days, depending on how much wheat they've got, they can literally lose hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so there's a little window, sometimes as short as 2 weeks, where they've got to get the harvest in. And so what do you think the farmer does when he looks out and he sees fields and fields of wheat and their whole income for the year depends on them getting it in on time and they've got a couple of days? What do? Bring in the workers. Like, get as many people in, get all the big machines, and we've got to get the wheat in. Well, Jesus looks at this crowd and he sees a field of wheat and says, it's harvest time. We've got to get it in. These people need me, the good shepherd. They need to come to me. And so what we need is workers. We need people who will go out and tell them, we have found the shepherd. Come follow him. He leads, he protects, he provides. Come, we've found the good shepherd. The need is workers. We've recently just started rewatching the movie Titanic, like a blast from the past. But, you know, it tells the story of this unsinkable ship that sank when it hit an iceberg in 1912. And tragically, over 1,500 people died. And many of those deaths could have been prevented. But there were four mistakes that were made that led to so many people dying. The first mistake was that there weren't enough lifeboats. So there's no way they could have saved all the passengers because they didn't have enough boats on board. In the same way, in New Zealand, there are not enough churches. Now, lots of buildings, but those buildings are empty for so many of them, and there aren't enough people in those buildings proclaiming Jesus. And so there are hundreds of thousands of people dying apart from Jesus. The second mistake that caused the disaster at the Titanic was that the crew didn't know how to use the lifeboats. And so they didn't lower them properly, and many were broken as they lowered them. Friends, in the same way, we need to train people to proclaim Jesus. We need to equip one another to be able to speak about Jesus, the Good Shepherd, so that we're better at explaining the good news of the gospel. We need to train people who will not be afraid to teach the Bible. The third reason why so many people died in the Titanic disaster is that the rich people got into the boats and the poor people were left behind. And you think, how does that happen? That's so sad, isn't it? And yet it's possible for us to do the same thing. Willing to plant churches and take the message of Jesus to rich, wealthy areas, but neglect the poor regions. Willing to take the gospel to places where we can keep living kind of comfortable, Western, middle-class lives, but not really willing to go to places where life's going to be harder. Like every time I go to Queenstown, I get this massive calling from the Lord to plant a church there. I never get that when I drive through Dunsandal. Like, I don't know, like, you know, but the message of Jesus needs to go everywhere, doesn't it? Wherever there are people, wherever there are lost sheep. And New Zealand's a rural country, so we need people who are going to move away from the city, and it might be harder for them, and they're going to go to the country, and they're going to proclaim Jesus. But it's not just New Zealand. What about places where poverty is a reality and living conditions are really poor? You see, we must not make the decision about where to proclaim the gospel based on wanting to maintain our living standards, or we're in danger of being no different to the rich people in the Titanic who let the poor people drown. The fourth reason so many people died, and the one I really want to draw your attention to today, is that the people who were safe in the lifeboats lacked the compassion to go back and save those who were drowning. You might remember the scenes in the Titanic if you've seen the movie, and there's these half-full lifeboats. There's plenty of space for others, but the people in those boats lack the compassion to go back and save people who are drowning in the freezing cold water. They're worried that maybe the boats will capsize, so we're just going to stay here where we're safe. Worried that they might upset the order of things, so let's just keep our distance. And so they stay out away from the drowning people and just wait for the screaming to stop. Isn't that awful? And yet I worry that we can do the same thing. And that there are churches all over the country that are half full of Christians who think, it's okay, we're here, we're safe. And we do nothing to go out and get the people who aren't in the church. Christians who think it's okay, we're comfortable, and they don't do anything to save the lost sheep all around them. Friends, we cannot be like that. We cannot just sit here and wait for the screaming to stop. Now, I think a danger for us at Latimer Church is to think that we're a big church and that therefore we're okay. We're four congregations, 600 people on a Sunday, and we think, you know, we're pretty big, we're doing all right. Friends, we're tiny. We're 600 people living in a city of 400,000 people who are dying apart from Jesus, the Good Shepherd. And so we're going to go and find as many people as we can, because people desperately need Jesus. And it might upset things here, like maybe things will change. Maybe there'll be all kinds of people here that we think, oh my goodness, how are we going to deal with that? But praise God. So the great need is Jesus, people need Jesus, and therefore the solution is workers, people who will tell others about Jesus, because the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Before I finish with three simple application points, I want to show you a few statistics for our own country, just to raise our awareness of the need. So if you like statistics, here's some numbers. In New Zealand, there are 5.2 million people, that's our current population, and according to a recent study by Faith and Belief, the Wilberforce Foundation, they reckon there's about 31% of the population who profess to be Christians. We're waiting for the census data to still come out on that, but I suspect it's about right. 31% of New Zealanders claim to be Christians. Now that number, therefore, is this number on the screen, 1.6 million people who profess to be Christians. Now, that doesn't mean that they're in churches. It just means that they claim to be Christians. Maybe they were baptized as a kid or something. They've got some affiliation. They'd call themselves Christians. If you were to actually count the number of Kiwis who were in church and in a church that teaches the Bible and proclaims Jesus, that number would be way smaller, probably less than 2%. But if, let's just say, those 31% of New Zealanders were actually in Bible-teaching, Jesus-proclaiming churches, we would need 16,000 gospel workers based on one gospel worker for every 100. And then if we were to reach just 10% of people in our country who are not professing faith in Jesus, well, we would need another 3,600 gospel workers. So you put those two numbers together, and for us just to reach all of the people who profess to be Christians plus 10% of those who don't, we would need over 20,000 gospel workers, one gospel worker for every 100 people. Now, I don't know how many we have at the moment, but let me tell you, it is nowhere near 20,000. I think it would be under 1,000. I hope I'm wrong, but the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. And friends, that's just New Zealand, and we're tiny. That doesn't include Japan, with a population of 123 million people and only 1.5% of people claim to be Christians. And nor does it include the 7,217 unreached people groups that Sarah prayed for earlier. There's a website called the Joshua Project, and it's set up to kind of help us reach people who've never heard of Jesus. And they categorize an unreached people group as being a group of people among which there is no indigenous community of believing Christians with adequate numbers to evangelize the people around them. And so they've worked out there's 7,217 people groups in that boat, and that represents 3.44 billion people. 3.44 billion people have never heard of Jesus, the Good Shepherd. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. And so let me finish with three brief points of application. I wondered about having commitment cards tonight so that we can kind of like, I'm going to commit to doing something. But you know, the problem with that is they don't last. What we actually need is change in our hearts, don't we? So that we actually have this gut-wrenching compassion for the lost. And so I pray that God would give us that, because only God can do that. Only God can change my heart so I have it, and only God can change yours. And he does it as we see how compassionate Jesus has been to us. So our real prayer is that we would have this compassion. But when we do, three things we ought to do. Number one, pray for gospel workers. Pray for gospel workers. Notice that is what Jesus tells his disciples to do, verse 38. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. God is the one who will raise up workers, because he is the Lord of the harvest. He is the good shepherd who will gather his lost people. He is the one who cares more for the salvation of his people than anyone else. He will save sheep and then send them out as shepherds. He will gather the harvest and then send them out as harvesters, and so we must pray. And no prayer is ever wasted. God looks at our country and he is filled with compassion. So pray to the Lord of the harvest. Pray that God would raise up godly men and women who give themselves wholeheartedly to gospel work. Pray. Secondly, be a gospel worker. Pray for gospel workers and be a gospel worker. It's striking that the very people Jesus tells to pray for gospel workers in chapter 9 are then the people he sends out to be gospel workers in chapter 10. So in chapter 10, verse 1, Jesus calls his disciples to him and he gives them authority to drive out evil spirits and to heal every disease and sickness, to continue the ministry Jesus was doing. And he sends them out in verse 7 and he says, as you go, preach this message, the kingdom of heaven is near. The same people he said pray to God to raise up workers, he now sends as workers. Now, it is true that every Christian is called to be a gospel worker, not just paid ministry staff, but every follower of Jesus is commanded by Jesus to go and make followers of Jesus. Every disciple is to be a disciple maker. And so if you're a follower of Jesus, you are to be about gospel work. And the question, therefore, that every one of us needs to ask tonight is, what am I doing to be a gospel worker? What am I doing, or what could I do to help save the lost and to show people Jesus the Good Shepherd? What are the gifts that God has given you that you could put to use to that end? Where has God placed you where you have opportunities to speak of Jesus? I heard a story recently of a woman who only became a Christian quite recently, and then she was at this kind of work dinner with a bunch of colleagues, and they'd heard she'd become a Christian, and so they kind of sneered at her and asked in this kind of mocking way, oh, I heard you got into this church thing, what's that all about? That kind of comment. And do you know how she replied? Such a good answer. She says, yeah, I have started going to church, and it is the best thing ever. Like, it has changed my life. I used to think Jesus was a load of rubbish. I was never into church, but as I found out about Jesus, he has just changed me so much. It's been the best thing that's ever happened. Isn't that a good way to speak about Jesus? She's not just wagging the finger, oh yes, I'm going to church and you should be there too. No, it's just Jesus has changed me. I found the Good Shepherd. You should come too. So what could you do to be a gospel worker? And we don't just do this gospel work alone. We do it together as God's people. It's one of the reasons that I love the things that we have as a church to help introduce people to Jesus, like the life course. It's one of the things I love about it. The life course starts not tomorrow, but the week after, on Monday night. And the aim is really simple. It's so that people might come and hear about Jesus the Good Shepherd and hear the invite to follow him. Now, who runs the life course? You do. Like we do. The whole church does. It involves all of us because we all need to be praying and we all need to be inviting. And then we have a whole team of people who have loads of different gifts. We've got people cooking in the kitchen. We've got people who are helping with the graphic design. We've got people who are there welcoming people when they arrive. We've got people at the tables to help kind of oil the conversation. Let's use that word. And then we've got people who do some of the follow-up. Like, it's this whole team of people who are all different and gifted in different ways, but we're all uniting together. Why? Because we want to reach lost sheep. So you don't all have to be the same. You don't all have to be the biggest, bravest evangelists. But we all need to be doing something with the gifts God has given us to see lost people saved. Now, while it's true that every Christian should be a gospel worker, I take it that when Jesus says to pray for gospel workers, he has in mind those in particular who will be set aside for the work in a particular way. And so from among the crowd, he calls his disciples and he sends them out, set aside by others for the work of proclaiming the good news of Jesus. And so, friends, there will be some men and women here tonight who, in response to this passage, need to make some big changes. For some, it will mean giving up your secular work and being equipped and trained for full-time gospel work. For some, it will mean moving overseas to take the gospel to some unreached people groups. I remember considering full-time ministry. I was building at the time, and I was kind of doing a little bit of Bible teaching and a little bit of evangelism, and I was enjoying it, and I thought, man, I can really see the need. But I also became aware of how much it cost to train up gospel workers and support them, and so I thought, you know, I'll just keep building houses and I'll make a big buck and I'll be generous and I'll fund other people to do gospel work. But then a wise pastor said to me, Tim, there's actually quite a few people in church life who are willing to give their money to gospel work, but there aren't many people actually willing to do it. And I thought, that's true. And it continues to ring true today. I can raise money to plant churches pretty quickly because people want to give their money to the work of the kingdom, but what I can't find is godly men who will go and plant them. The need is great, and there'll be some here who, because of their particular gifts and above all else their godliness, they ought to be set aside for the work of the gospel. And I pray that God would give those men and women such a compassion for the lost that they can do nothing else. One of the ways we seek to raise up full-time gospel workers here at Latimer is through our apprenticeship program, which we've already heard about tonight. And when you came in this evening, you were given a little brochure with a bit of information about that, and I encourage you to take that away and think and pray. If you're not sure where to start, that's a great place, and do reach out to us. It's our prayer that we would be able to increase the number of apprentices in the years to come, and I pray some of you might make the brave decision to give yourself to that work. So friends, pray for gospel workers, be gospel workers, and then thirdly, and just quickly, fund gospel workers. If we're going to set aside godly and gifted men and women who proclaim Jesus, it will cost us financially. And as Jesus sends out his disciples on mission in chapter 10, he tells them not to take any money with them, but to rely on the generosity of God's people to provide. And so in chapter 10, verse 10, he says, "The worker is worth his wages. While some of you might give up your jobs to do more ministry, others of us ought to give up money to help fund them." And friends, if we are going to raise up 20,000 gospel workers for New Zealand, we're going to need to be sacrificially generous with our money to pay for men to be and women to be trained and set aside for the work of the gospel. Not driven by some kind of legalism like, you know, I feel a bit bad, I should give some money. Not because some punk pastor told you you should give some money, but driven by a real deep compassion for the lost. I'm going to sacrificially and generously and joyfully give money so that I can send that person to proclaim Jesus in that place to those people. So pray for gospel workers, be a gospel worker, and fund gospel workers. I'm going to stop there, and we're going to take a moment in a minute to give some time to think about this and for you to consider your own life and what you could do to help. But before we do that, I've actually asked four people just to share briefly how the need for gospel workers has shaped the way that they live and their thinking. These guys are not coming up because they've got it all together and some of them were reluctant to speak, but I think they are thinking about it carefully, and it's helpful for us to hear practically what this might look like. So I'll invite those guys to come up. Calvin, I'm going blank on who I've got, so you know who you are. Come on up. Calvin, Andrew, Michelle, and Shamath. Thank you. Come on up. And Calvin, you're first up, so we're going to start with you, and you've got the microphone. Look at that. I'm just going to ask all of you just one really simple question, and the question is, how does this need for gospel workers shape the way that you think and seek to live as a Christian?
Well, when I was a young Christian, when I pondered those verses, I always thought that it was talking about sending out workers, so I always thought it was talking about people that want to be missionaries over in Papua New Guinea or somewhere else in a country overseas. But later on in my life, I realized that it was actually the harvest field that it was talking about was actually something that I had. I had my own harvest field. So the impact on my life is a personal one. The harvest field that I have is probably similar to you guys. I've got neighbors. I've got work colleagues that I work with every day. I've got family that need to know Jesus. So that's the harvest field. And I have fears with sharing about Jesus to those groups of people. So I pray, and I try to pray daily to that the Holy Spirit would be working and opportunities would come up with those groups of people. I also pray for myself that I'd be courageous and bold, because that's something that I need to do, and to be proactive. Tim asked me to share a couple of areas where I'm involved in gospel-type work. One is I'm involved in a weekly prison ministry, which meets on a Wednesday with a group of guys that I've got to know. And we regularly meet with ex-prisoners, and also some of the guys go into prison itself. The other thing would be Sonia and I support financially a young woman in Dunedin who's part of student life, and she is there to share the gospel with students, and we regularly hear about her and people that are coming to the Lord, so it's a real encouragement to us. I probably don't sit in church and be overwhelmed with compassion, but what I've realised is that the more I get involved and the more encouragement I get, my faith grows, and so does my compassion for the lost and the way I can share the gospel with other people. That's mine.
Thank you. I see Michelle's got a microphone. Michelle, do you want to tell us how this need has shaped your life?
Yes, sure. I think just thinking about, just my priorities and the decisions that I make. And so thinking about my decision to move here to New Zealand and I thought just how much I had been impacted by being in student ministry, so being discipled and really wanting God to use my life to impact people with the gospel. And so that led me to laying down the plans that I had after graduating college, which was to get my master's and go to grad school. But then deciding to follow God's leading and labor on the college campus here in New Zealand. And so, yeah, I think it can be easy to think, man, like, what difference can I make with just my life? Because, I mean, hearing the Great Commission, like, that's a big task to go and make disciples of all nations. But I think, yeah, just thinking through, oh, who are the people that God has called me to in my life and that we all have a part to play? I think thinking about how much God can do through our faithfulness to be available and, to meet with the people in our lives. And so I think of the girl who discipled me in college. So she was just really faithful to, meet with me every week. So teaching me what it looked like to just walk with Jesus daily, and how much that had an impact on me. And how her investment in my life is now impacting the students that I get to meet with here in New Zealand on campus. And I also think about the girl who I was able to disciple in college. So she is actually also working in full-time ministry now at the campus that we both went to. And yesterday I was reading her newsletter and I found out that her youngest sister has recently come to faith. And so, her family comes from a Mormon background. And so something that she has been praying for a really long time is that God would save her whole family. And so seeing how God is using her to reach not only students on the college campus, but also reaching her family with the gospel. And so I think just seeing God's faithfulness, from my discipler investing in my life and then me getting to invest in the girl who I discipled in her life and seeing how much God can do with our faithfulness to meet with people in our lives. And so something that I pray for each of the girls that I meet with is that God would grow them each to be a disciple maker. And so not only just praying for them and their lives, but praying for the people who they will go on to disciple and meet with and people that they'll impact with the gospel. I think just thinking through who are the people in my life that I can start investing in and what might that look like? And even asking what is God asking me to lay down, I think are just some helpful things to think about and questions that really helped me. So.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I want to pass the microphone to Chamath. You mentioned there what are the things that need to lay down. And Chamath, you've been thinking about that a wee bit. How does this need for gospel workers shape you and particularly the last few months?
Yeah, so I actually grew up in a non-Christian family. So when I became a Christian, it was quite a transformative thing. I was living a life that was very much, I would say, worldly. But when I realized that actually having a relationship with Jesus is something real, when you find out that God is real, it makes a humongous difference in your how you make choices in life. And as I grew and as I grew more mature in my Christian walk, I remember being intentionally being discipled by quite a few of the men and from the church that I was attending at the time. And one of the things that really shaped how I think about, especially about transformation, is I see the impact that I've had, especially being discipled, and also how that's been kind of shaped my prayer life. So continuing to pray for where God's leading, having clarity. But one of the things that really, really stood out to me is having a strong conviction. Actually, these men have totally invested so much time, not just men, but their families as well. And I kind of felt like, oh my goodness, what level of compassion should I need to have in terms of to be able to actually imitate that same thing? I think in the Bible we are called to imitate Christ. Paul calls us to imitate a life that is actually, well, imitate a life that's more like Christ. And I kind of thought, I think one of the best ways that I can do it is there are lots of people who doesn't know the gospel. There are lots of people who do know the gospel, but doesn't necessarily know what it looks like to live it out. Pretty much gathering from my experience, my learning, and my own understanding of the Bible, I started catching up with a couple of the people and reading one-on-one. But one of the things that Tim alluded to is actually considering, hey, what does it look like to do full-time? I think I started that journey quite some time ago. One of the practical things that I did was actually going down to 4 days a week in terms of working and then having a day free, just making myself available to do ministry. One of the things that came out of it is I started doing quite a few kids ministry-related work, and one of the things that I've got involved in is Bibles in Schools. Now, that's actually a ministry that is quite close to me, because when I was a child, I knew who Jesus was, but never had like an idea of he's died for me. But even having that opportunity, actually, this is somewhere that you can actually take the gospel and start the journey with someone that people that I don't know who doesn't know the gospel as well. So that's kind of lots of things. When you make yourself available, I think the plate just fills up. So hopefully
thank
I answered
you.
The question.
That's right. Thank you. And last one, Andrew. Thanks.
Yeah. So last year I was studying to be an architectural technician, and I remember sitting in a bus, and I love listening to sermons. I'm a real nerd for sermons. So I was listening to a sermon, and it was about preaching the gospel to others. And I looked out on the bus, and I just kind of saw all these different people. And the bus is a great way to see like just everyday New Zealanders, isn't it? And you had one person who was crying, another person who was on the phone, and I was like, here I am with my headphones on and my own world, going off to do my own thing, and yet I'm doing nothing for these people. And so I think I got this real heart to just, how can I best use myself to share about Jesus? And so that led me into the ministry apprenticeship. And one of the things that I get to do as part of the apprenticeship is to work in rest homes and just leading a little Bible study with some others and just doing a little service and preaching the gospel. And one of the joys is just seeing these older Christians faithfully come and just share their life, share their struggles, share how they're doing. And yeah, it's just a real encouragement to me. And the biggest highlight is hearing them talk about how they share it with other people. And I think, isn't that awesome? Isn't that these 80-year-old people, these 9-year-old people are so on fire for Jesus? And they're gospel workers in their rest time, but they're just living it out day to day. And so that's a real encouragement, and it's just a real blessing to be able to do that, the apprenticeship through Latimer, because we get support. Many churches aren't able to support apprentices, but here at Latimer we have this great opportunity to do that, and it's a great blessing for myself and for the other apprentices as well.
Thank you very much, guys. Do have a seat, and I appreciate you being willing to share those thoughts. We're going to take a moment now so you can just weigh up the things that you've heard. As Jesus says, that they are sheep without a shepherd, and the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. So let me give you a few moments to think about what that might mean for you. On the back of that form about ministry apprentices, you will see that there's some ways you can support our apprentices, prayer and finances, and the details are all there. So let's take a moment to reflect ourselves. Attached to your service sheet, there's those little response slips. If you've got anything you'd like to comment on or ask about tonight, do fill those out as well. They'll be collected a little bit later on. But we'll have a short break now, and we'll get your attention back in just a minute.